Great. So let's start this series. Hello and welcome to this first event in our 2021 speaker series, Taking the Digital Welfare State to Court. My name is Judith Rauhofer and I am DFF's legal officer. And with me here are my colleagues, Jonathan McCulley, who is DFF's legal advisor, and our events officer, Shihan Jajan. We are together, will work behind the scenes to ensure that this webinar goes off smoothly and is not plagued by any technical difficulties. But my job is also to introduce you both to the series and our speaker and moderator tonight. To give you all a bit of background to the series, over the past 2 years, the protection and promotion of human rights in the context of the digital welfare state has been a major focus of DFF's work. We are particularly concerned that the increased use of digital technologies and automated decision-making systems in social security and welfare contexts violates human rights and exacerbates the over-policing and penalizing and exclusion of marginalized communities and those who are already in need of vital support. We've already discussed these issues at a number of our workshops, like for instance, our litigation algorithms workshop in 2019. And we've also already held a number of one-on-one and group consultations with a range of organizations working on the topic. And based on these consultations, we've produced a strategic document to inspire conversations on how strategic litigation could be used as part of a broader strategy to address the harms of the digital welfare state. Sorry. You can find that document, that strategic document, and more information about our other activities in this area on the DFF website. And we also continue to engage with a range of other organizations on this topic. And these include racial, social, and economic justice organizations as part of one of our new projects, Digital Rights for All. Our objective here is to provide a space to the people most affected by harmful uses of technologies, but who are often not the ones leading on the advocacy and policy or strategic litigation work, to develop their own agenda. And this is a process that one of my other colleagues, Laurence Meyer, who actually leads on that project, has just summarized in a very readable, and I would recommend this to you, blog post as Nothing About Us Without Us. So this year's speaker series seeks to complement all of that work by exploring a range of cases from different jurisdictions and relating to a range of different digital welfare issues to show how strategic litigation can be used by and in collaboration with these communities to protect their digital and human rights. And of course, here at DFF, where our motto is digital rights are human rights. The topic of today's event is battling Aadhaar in India, and it looks at the way in which the mandated use of the Indian Aadhaar system, described as the world's largest biometric ID system, has affected specifically the food security of people living in poverty in India. With us today to do this are Colin Gonsalves, a senior advocate of the Supreme Court of India, and Malavika Jayaram, who is the executive director of Digital Asia Hub Singapore. Colin is the founder of Human Rights Law Network, HRLN, India's leading public interest law group, which grew from small acorns since its foundation in 1983, so that's some time ago, into a national organization that now brings together over 200 lawyers and paralegals operating out of 28 offices spread throughout India. He has brought numerous precedent-setting cases to the Indian Supreme Court and also to the high courts of various states. For his work, he has received a number of prestigious awards, including the International Human Rights Award by the American Bar Association, the Mother Teresa Memorial Award for Social Justice in recognition of his remarkable contribution in legal services addressing human rights, an award for the Center for Reproductive Rights in New York for pioneering and exemplary leadership in advancing women's reproductive rights and social justice in India, and the Right Livelihood Award. He was also conferred an honorary doctorate by the University of Middlesex in the UK. Malavika is the inaugural executive director of the Digital Asia Hub. This is an independent research think tank incubated by the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society, where she was also a resident fellow prior to her relocation to Hong Kong to take this on. And she continues to engage her engagement with the Berkman Institute as a faculty associate. Technology lawyer for over 50 years. 15 years, she practiced law at Allen & Overy in London, and she was vice president and technology counsel at Citigroup. She was also a visiting scholar at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, and she's had fellowships at the University of Sydney and the Institute of Technology and Society in Rio de Janeiro. She's taught India's first course on information technology and law in 1997. So as you can see, we have two real experts in the area of digital rights and litigation with us. So I will shortly be handing over to Malavika as the moderator of this event, and she and Colin will spend about 30 minutes to talk about the background of the Aadhaar case that we're here to hear about tonight and about the lessons we can learn from it. And while they're talking, we would encourage all participants to use the Q&A function that you can find at the bottom of the screen, just to the right, to ask any questions that you may have about the case. We will have about 20 to 25 minutes at the end of the webinar, towards the end of the webinar, to allow Colin to answer as many of your questions as possible. So I would really, really encourage you to make use of this opportunity and to participate, you know, actively participate in the event. And on that note, and without further ado, Malavika, Colin, you've got the floor.
Thank you so much, Judith. It's so, so wonderful to be here with all of you and to do this for an organization that I feel very warm feelings for Nani and the rest of the team, who do really, really important work in supporting strategic litigation in so many places on extremely important matters. I'm especially happy to be in conversation with Colin Gonsalves, who is a real institution in India. Aadhaar is only the tip of the iceberg. As Judith mentioned, he's worked on so many public interest litigation matters in India, addressing so many matters of socio-political and cultural harms that we could be in conversation with him for all six webinars. To sort of narrow down the focus of this session, I just wanted to say a couple of quick words before asking Colin the very first question. And it was, you know, when Aadhaar was implemented, we had so many people saying things like, oh, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to lose, right? Which is something that we're all very familiar with is in this space. And if you look at sort of Professor Daniel Solove's response to how terrible this nothing to hide argument is, he mentions that Anne Bartow disagrees with his taxonomy. And in doing so, she mentions this idea that there aren't enough, to paraphrase, dead bodies in privacy, right? That if you only talk about privacy in very dry analytical terms, you fail to animate people into caring about this right. And it sort of ignores the fact that you can negatively impact the life of living, breathing people. And that the taxonomy of, you know, tort law and other kinds of privacy rights doesn't have enough dead bodies. And that privacy's lack of blood and death, or at least of broken bones and buckets of money, distances privacy from other categories of law. In this instance, she's talking about tort law, but we'll leave that aside. And I think the case that we're going to discuss with Colin is particularly important because it does implicate dead bodies. It does show that when you have surveillance and privacy harms underway, it actually can implicate living, breathing people, and that the consequences of violation of privacy or of efforts to evade it can have incredibly fatal consequences for people. And it's not something that's a privilege. It's not something that Western liberal economies enjoy. It's not something that stays within the digital realm. It is something very visceral, compelling, that addresses the most fundamental and basic of rights, including hunger, poverty, education. And I think, you know, with that in mind, just as a sort of framing comment, Colin, if you could tell us a little bit about the origin story of this litigation, which involves the right to food and the specific case of the mother who is going to court to protest the death of her daughter due to the request to link Aadhaar with ration cards. Could you just spell out the background for this litigation?
Right, Malvika. So the story actually begins as far back as the year 2000, when I moved to the Supreme Court and we set up our Delhi office here. And it was a casual visit to Rajasthan, a very beautiful city, a very beautiful state. And we went to see the houses and meet the people who had died of starvation. And we met them and talked to them and so on. And we were coming away when we noticed that close to the house was a huge granary running maybe 60, 70, 80, 90 feet into the air. Huge granary overflowing with grain. And it struck us that we are in India, which has the largest reserves of grain in the world. Today, it's at about 110 million tons. And you have starvation deaths, maybe 300, 400, 500 in the last few years. So how is it that a country which boasts of a GDP of 7%, one of the highest in the world, and considers itself to be a world tiger, economic tiger, how is it that people die of starvation? And we went to the Supreme Court, and to cut a long story short, because we have an incredible jurisprudence in India, which is public interest litigation, which allows people, NGOs, individuals, academics, to go directly to the Supreme Court and ask for the enforcement of fundamental rights. That's a long story. That's another story. And this kind of system you really don't have in the world at all. Colombia has traces of that. Mexico has. Nepal has a wonderful system. But in the developed world, you will not hear any story of judges of the high courts and Supreme Court saying to the government that you must give people the right to housing, the right to food, the right to education, the right to water, and so on and so forth. And we got wonderful orders from the Supreme Court, which expanded the right to food in India over a period of 18 years. One of the longest lasting social action cases in the country. And eventually, 700 million people were covered by a subsidized food system and received grain from the state at less than half the market rate. We got a midday meal for students. We got a right to work system in place called the National Rural Employment Guarantee Act. And we got the midday meal, I mentioned, for students right across the country. So it was a huge victory. But we were celebrating too soon. Because just as we won the case and the World Bank was very upset that the Indian subsidies on food had skyrocketed because of court orders. And the World Bank was very keen that we close down a public distribution system, just as they persuaded Mexico and other countries to close down. Then we had the counterattack in the form of a digital identification system, ostensibly to curb corruption. The stated purpose was there's so much of corruption, people have two kind of ration cards, they're collecting ration twice, so we need a digital system. And they brought in Aadhaar. There was a huge fight in the courts, but I'll not get into that right now. But the Aadhaar system required you to possess an Aadhaar card, not a big problem. So everybody went and got it, even though the constitutionality was challenged in the courts and partially won. That case was partially won. But that card had to be networked. It had to be seeded and linked with a ration card and connected to a network, which required, among other things, your fingerprint to be digitally verified, your iris to be digitally checked. And ultimately, once you go through all these layers of surveillance and checking and so on, ostensibly to cut down corruption, you will get your grain, which you were getting so simply before, by merely trotting up to your ration shop in your village, giving him your ration card. He'll give you the grain, and you stamp your ration card for the month and you get your grain and come back. And the digital system had all kinds of problems. You must understand, India is a country of 1,200 million people. The literacy rate is very high. Illiteracy, hunger, malnutrition, all these statistics are very, very high. So poor people in the villages, and particularly the indigenous people, and I'm going to tell you immediately about the case which was of the tribal in the state of Jharkhand in India, an indigenous tribe. They really don't know what digital systems are. They don't know the importance of biometrics and so on, or unique identification, as the Indian government puts it. They don't know these things. So you take advantage of their illiteracy. And I don't know if I'm using the right gullibility. They would believe anything the government official tells them. And so Aadhaar was used in India on a very large scale to exclude the poor from the right to food system. Amazing. You start by saying we want to weed out corruption, and you end up weeding out poor people completely from the system. So people had all kinds of problems. That seeding was a huge problem. People didn't know. They got the card, the Aadhaar identification, but they don't know what seeding is all about. And if there's a problem, they don't know how to solve it. Internet in the villages is very on and off, weak. And students, for example, who are trying to study digitally have to climb trees in the rural areas sometimes to catch the signal and so on. Iris identification, you know, in the villages and so on, it may work, may not work. Laborers who are using axes and working the whole day, right? Their thumbprints won't show up when you ask for a digital thumbprint. And so the case is a story about a family in Jharkhand, terribly poor family. You must remember, in India, out of 1,200 million people, roughly half of them, so you say 500, 600 million people, below a poverty line of $2 a day, 2 euros a day, since I'm talking to people in Berlin. Can you imagine the level of poverty in these countries and in our country? So anyway, the story starts with this not working, the seeding system not working. I have a card. I've been getting my ration from this ration shop for the last 10 years. And all of a sudden, the contractor says, I'm sorry, your card has been discontinued. Why? Because your seeding is not working. So what? The seeding is not working? No. It means there's something wrong. It means there's some hanky-panky going on with your grain. And he stops it. And the family is not combative. We need a little bit of Latin American blood in our people, I think, you know, to immediately go, you know, and do things which can't be spoken of on in a conference like this. And really do rough stuff with the government. And I wish that would happen. But we are a quiet people. We are a non-violent people, poor at least. So we go and plead, and we go and plead, and we go and plead, and this middleman, this operator of the public distribution shop abuses us, pushes us, threatens us, and doesn't give us grain for 3-4 months and more. When this 11-year-old girl, who's been hanging on by drinking water in the morning, filling her stomach with water, and then the next day fill your stomach with water, and then the neighbors run out of food, and she just dies. She just withers away and dies. And then it comes in all the papers, and we go to the house, and, you know, belatedly, and we take a video of what she's saying. We do a press conference, and the nation is shocked by this starvation death. And then the government officials come in and say, oh no, she didn't die of starvation. She died because she had a fever, or she had diarrhea and things like that. And it's the same story again and again and again. And like this in our country, because of this horrible digital system, upwards of 1 million people have lost their ration cards. And our Prime Minister was so proud to say, well, our campaign against corruption has been successful, so successful that millions of ration cards have been cancelled, as they were fraudulent, bogus, as we say, fraudulent. He made a triumphant political statement on the deaths of very, very poor people. And so that's the story of this litigation. We went to the Supreme Court, we filed the case. The court is looking into and investigating starvation deaths in the country at the time where the Indian economy was at its best. And nobody wants to accept it. Nobody wants to believe it. They feel it defames India to talk of starvation deaths in the country. It's a defamatory statement. You are blackmailing your own country. You are bringing down your own country in the eyes of the world. And nobody wants to touch it. And this is the case where we are asking for the restoration of all the ration cards that were discontinued and compensation paid to the families that lost their near and dear ones due to the total negligence and cruelty of the Indian government. That's the introduction to the case in a nutshell.
Colin, thank you so much. I think it was really helpful to locate it against the broader scheme of Aadhaar and, you know, the sort of origin myths around why it was necessary in the first place to eliminate corruption, as you say, and these duplicate identities, as the founder was always happy to say, that the ghosts in the machine, right? All the, and to deduplicate and de-anonymize and only allow legitimate bodies in the system. I wonder if I could draw you out a little on how the case has been proceeding. What is the status? What orders have you received so far? What were the arguments that you chose to make? Because I know a lot of this audience is very keen on the use of litigation as a tactical strategic tool. So it would be really great to hear about the specific arguments put forth before the court in this case.
Right. A right to food cases, the arguments are very, very simple. And I think as systems of public interest law become better and better, it becomes easier and easier to explain how it works. Anything really good should be capable of explanation in simple terms. Public interest litigation is a totally Indian innovation. Years back in the 80s, maybe even earlier, where judges who were socially inclined asked themselves the question, how do we make our court system accessible to the poor, more than half of whom are illiterate and half of whom are, you know, below the poverty line? What is the use of having a judicial system if the poor can't access it? And the answer to that was public interest litigation, where they said we must open our doors to the poor wherever they are. And the first thing they did, and I think the Western world could well learn from India, though the Western world is very loath to learn from a developing country, is to develop a new notion of locus standi, or your standing to do a case. And in many jurisdictions, you must be personally affected, right, to file a case. But how do people in the villages of India who can't get bus fare to come to the city to do the case, or can't get money to even pay for the typing of their litigation, how do poor people maintain a case and come to a court and pay their lawyer and get a case done. And locus standi was changed in this dramatic way. Any person acting in good interest, bona fide, as we say, can file a case on behalf of one person, 100 persons, and in the right to food case on behalf of 350 million people. And we don't have this very convoluted American system of class action certification, where you have to show that you are members of a class and so on. There's no certification at all. The judges use basic common sense. They say, yes, all those who are facing malnutrition, hunger, and starvation form a class. So we filed a single case. There's a single petitioner. It covers the entire country, and it seeks relief on behalf of roughly 500 million people. And the cost of that case is maybe $100.
I noticed also there's a little bit of the David and Goliath in this, because there are 4 lawyers in your office and 82 respondent lawyers that you've implicated. So I was particularly struck when I saw the documentation from your office. Could you tell us where the case is at the moment? What's the status? What's been the result? What are the successes so far?
Yes. Well, I told you the first stage of the case, the success was basically that the subsidized system of grain extended to about roughly 600 million people.
Million, yes.
700 million people who get grain at half the market rate. And then I told you this, they have this right to work system now, which covers millions of people and so on. On the starvation death case, it's at a middle level. Mm-hmm. Where the court has accepted the petition as a public interest petition, is shocked by the data that is contained therein of starvation deaths, which sometimes judges find very hard to believe, has asked the government of India and all the state governments to give an answer as to how it is that starvation has happened on such a large scale. And why is it that no one has taken any care to look after the families that are suffering even today and starving even today as we speak? While the case pends in court, people still die of starvation. And so the government has come and filed affidavits saying the story that I told you, that, well, this was a rooting out corruption initiative. And well, we think we are perfectly right, and we don't accept this thing about starvation. And we think people die of all kinds of things, like malaria and jaundice and this, that, and the other, snake bites, falling into wells. But we are not sure that really there is any case of a person actually starving to death in India, although it is well documented. And so now, in this year, in the next few months, I think, this case will be heard finally in the Supreme Court. And I think as far as starvation is concerned, and non-providing of ration cards to people and the restoration of ration cards that have been disconnected, I think we are going to get as fine an order, as good an order, as we got in the first stage of litigation, where there was a massive coverage of subsidized grain for the country as a whole, which resulted, by the way, in a new enactment called the Food Security Act 2013. Right. Yeah, so for the first time, the earlier orders were judge-made orders. And in India, in our constitution, an order of the court, the High Court or the Supreme Court, is on par with a statute and enforceable as such. But it's always better to have a statute in black and white giving you your rights. That statute came in with the Food Security Act 2013.
Thank you. I note particularly when you mentioned how difficult it is to talk about this in the media, and how the government is claiming that this never happens. I know it's a very vulnerable, sensitive issue. But I also note that due to the attention that this case has drawn, the starvation death case, that there's been a lot more activity, there's been a lot more media coverage, there's been a lot more attention to an issue that the government would otherwise like to throw under the carpet. Has your office been collaborating with other activists or other actors in this space towards leveraging this moment to push the right to food campaign in other directions or to strengthen activism in this regard? Like, how has this litigation helped move the needle on this cause?
Well, litigation in India is never litigation by itself. The real energy givers behind litigation are actually the social activists in the field. Not really the lawyer. We take a little bit of credit where it is not much due, but the real people who come with the facts, the real people who go to the families in faraway places and collect their affidavits, the persons who make the documentaries and the videos which we produce in court, the real people are the activists of India, the social workers of India, and that's magical about India. If there's anything spiritual about India, it's truly the lives of these activists who, despite having very little money, sometimes very well educated, but very little money, and working in remote areas with people, dedicating their lives for the fight against injustice, it is these people who bring all the documentation to the court. It is they who tell us how to fight it. It is they who tell us what to ask for. It is they who give the answers to the judges' 101 questions. And it is they who, when we win a case, it is they who point out disobedience of the court order to enable us to file contempt of court actions against the government. So we cannot work. No one, no lawyer in the country can work without being part of an alliance of NGOs, struggle organizations, trade unions, tribal groups, women's organizations, disability groups, Dalit groups. India is a magical network of truly spiritual fighters, freedom fighters. And that is... Yeah, go ahead.
No, please carry on.
Yeah, so if you come to India, you think India has lost its spiritualism, really. Because, you know, in the land of Mahatma Gandhi and non-violence, you know, this is a very violent country. We have no love for our nature. We have no respect for women. We traffic in children. You know, our attitudes towards the poor are very barbaric and brutal. And you'll think, oh my God, what happened to the India that I read about or I visited many, many years ago? But in the struggle for justice among the activists, millions of activists, you will see the flame of spiritualism burning very bright. And that is what results in success in the courts, because we fight it honestly. We fight it without compromise. And even a negative judge who's not willing to believe us, you know, can see over time that these are genuine people doing a tremendous battle for justice. And he cannot, despite his, you know, misgivings or biases, he cannot but recognize that truth will ultimately prevail. It's an amazing thing. And it's very joyous for lawyers like us to partake of this, you know, spiritual coming together of people to fight for justice. It's more than
that. It's very, very inspiring. It's really joyous to watch the joy with which you describe this. And I think it's particularly useful for this audience as well, where we talk a lot about intersectional work. We talk a lot about working across disciplinary backgrounds and silos and actually collaborating towards a cause and how it takes a village to push a lot of these very difficult issues. And I think it's wonderful the way you're describing how activists, lawyers, educators, academics have actually come together for this cause. Yesterday in an event that I was at, the architect Prem Chandavarkar reminded the audience that Satyagraha, which, you know, everyone thinks of as just civil disobedience, you know, which is the concept Gandhi's known for, he reminded my class that actually, literally, it means not just satya, the truth, but it's about a dogged insistence on the truth. It's a commitment to keep pushing for it, in the face of it not working, and it's this commitment to keep persevering with the truth in the face of everything that denies it, that is so powerful and compelling. And I think, you know, this description you've given us of how this case has been moving along is extremely powerful. We already have a couple of questions, and I'll take them in a minute. So thank you for those who've asked, and we look forward to a few others. If I could just ask you, Colin, before we open up for questions, what work do you think still remains to be done by courts and governments? You know, this is the sort of blue skies thinking. What next steps would you like to see? I know you already do a lot of work with internships for young law students. Maybe you could tell us a little about how you're seeding the next generation of activist lawyers. But if you could just tell us what more could be done about this issue and by whom, I think that would be really, really useful.
Yeah, Malvika, I must tell you about answering this question at the outset. We've taken just a small step. And I've lived many years of my life hoping that I would see India emerge as a democratic, fair country, where I would see poor people rise up out of poverty and hunger. But I must confess, it's become worse. So I'm giving you a little bit of a complicated story. Some elements of optimism and joy and success and victory. But I've seen my country become much, much worse on every front. And I feel I'm just living at a point of history where I must just persevere, have a lot of stamina, not give up, as people don't give up because they really have no choice, and fight and fight and fight in the hope that one day we will liberate ourselves from the chains that bind us by our own governments, earlier by a colonial power, but now by our own governments, our own democratically elected governments. What I would like to see is that this struggle becomes more intense. I am today not very satisfied with this Satyagraha business because it has an element of being very peaceful in the face of
passive. Yes.
You know, nonviolence is all right, and nonviolence is a very powerful weapon against oppression. But sometimes too much of nonviolence is also a little bit not a good thing. And a bit of resoluteness and the ability to resist physically the injustice perpetrated, because I've seen it happen again and again and again, brutalizing of the people worse than under British period. And people are ready to fight. And that's the amazing thing about it. They're ready to fight and push back. So what I'd really like to see is a young generation of new India who doesn't accept all these bogus principles of the older generation. Respect for the old, listening to powerful people, obeying orders, bowing down before authority. That was part of our older culture. But now I want people who would be disrespectful to people who would trample on the rights of people, who would not accept a statement from a person in authority unless they believe that that statement is genuine and correct, who will tear aside all this camouflage that the rich and powerful have, that government officials have, and be very rough and rude in attaining what they want. I'm sorry to say this, actually. It might not sound very nice, but I want people to be now, and I think the new generation will be, a fiery generation. Mobilization, moving towards uprisings against injustice. And I'm speaking not just of India, it's true of the whole world. Mm-hmm. The time has come, because the whole world is hurtling towards
time is up.
Destruction.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I'd like to see
I'm reminded while listening to you of the late John Lewis about making good trouble. And I think that's a really great aim for the next generation. So Colin, let me collate some of the questions that people have been raising. I think the first one I'll take is, Joseph has asked a couple of questions about alternatives to litigation. He's asked about how, you know, in this case, when technology goes wrong and it unleashes hardship on so many people, especially the poorest of the poor, what other tools than litigation might have given faster solutions? And he's sort of saying this in the context of how lengthy court proceedings can be, especially in India. So I wonder if you want to say something about what else other than litigation can help in these instances.
Yeah,
is there something faster? Yeah.
Yes. In fact, the mainstream for social change is struggle, unionization, organization. That's the mainstream. Mm-hmm. If you want to change society and you say the courts will change society, that's not correct.
Yeah.
It's not correct at all. The courts are only the last resort. When you have your backs to the wall and you really haven't been able to change the minds of government, no matter what, no matter publicity in the press and so on, as a last resort, clutching to a straw to get out of the situation in which you are in, courts play a role, a lesser or greater role. But generally, are the courts the instruments of social change? Not at all. Partially sometimes in some countries, in some situations. But the real agency of change is people mobilized and organized and fighting collectively for their rights.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think that actually leads very well to the next question from Amy, where she appreciates your comment about how one way marginalized people can get access to the legal system is through public interest litigation. She asks about ways for marginalized people to access not just the laws influencing Aadhaar, you know, not just the legal frameworks and the legal piece, but also the design of the technology itself, of the Aadhaar system and of the policies. So I guess she's asking about how this intersects with advocacy. How does advocacy and changing the actual design of the technology, how do those play out?
Malvika, I'm not sure I'm really capable of answering that question fully.
Sure.
But I could answer it by giving a reference to what was called the Arogya Setu app.
Yes.
It was for contact tracing in India, which was a terribly modified app here, which monitored you every 10 minutes. So it was a surveillance app. It followed you around and could say every 10 minutes where you're standing. So if you have COVID, for example, you test positive for COVID, the policeman can know exactly where to put you up and put you into a kind of a quarantine center and so on.
Yes.
And what many people in our country did was they looked at more benign ways. As an alternative, they looked at systems that were a little bit more compatible with privacy mm-hmm. and human rights principles, and fought against Arogya Setu on the grounds that it was totally unnecessary to have these parts of the application where other countries had a much more benign system that could, when you turn positive, could tell the owner of the app or the user of the app where to get certain medicines from and doctors from and so on, but no surveillance of the person and no uploading of data onto a central server.
Exactly.
That kind of stuff happened. But otherwise, I'm not sure really how to answer your question. I'm not so good on the technicalities of these things.
Actually, the next question also touches on technicalities a little bit, but let me throw it at you and see if you want to take a stab at it. So this is from Hinako Sugiyama, and she says, she has a question about the 2019 judgment. The majority opinion rejected applying the least intrusive test, partly because comparing several modes of identity, and here they're quoting, is a matter which may be better left to the experts to examine. So they're very concerned about the court's reluctance in stepping into a technical analysis, because I get the concern here is that technical experts might be all very well and good, but they lack a sufficient understanding of human rights. So is this carving out government's policies from stringent judicial review? So how can you stop this sort of, you know, technophobic fear in courts to address technical issues? How do we sort of address this, where courts just wash their hands off?
Yeah, I think the Supreme Court was totally wrong, because the time has long passed when courts could use the excuse that we are not technical experts and we must defer to technical experts, because technicalities come with ideology. Technicalities come with morality. Technicalities come with class and class perspectives. And if a judge says, I'll not get into this because the technical people are more proficient, it is a judge who's abdicating his duty under the Constitution of India, or any constitution for that matter. Therefore, judges must adapt to the changing times. And if technology and digital technology, for example, is rapidly changing, their minds too must rapidly advance with the times. And they must learn. They must be taught. They must be trained to understand. Because that is the core of oppression today. The core of oppression and mass oppression in society comes from technology of this kind.
Yeah. Colin, to sort of take the issues you've been discussing so far and, you know, completely noting the need for courts to adapt, Anisha from Malaysia is worried about the digital ID system in Malaysia, allegedly for purportedly similar reasons. And Anisha asks, in response to this particular death and this scandal, are there policies nationally or federally that have been implemented to mitigate the harms of excluding entire vulnerable groups of the population from the use of digital IDs? Have there been any changes in the strategy?
Not really. Not at all. There is some attempt to have a data protection law in this country, but that's taking ages.
Yes.
There is a pronouncement in Puttaswamy that if you want to collect data and so on, you must have a law permitting you to do that. But data has been collected right across the country brazenly without a law to back it up. And in the Arogya Setu case, that was our first argument, that if you are using this app ostensibly to help people detect whether they are COVID positive or not, in fact, you are collecting a huge amount of data, particularly health data, which all the health corporations and so on are very anxious to get their hands on, and they've got their hands on this. So legal protection comes many, many years later, by which time the deed is done. Aadhaar, while the case was going on, the Supreme Court didn't give a stay. And while arguments were going on and on and on, three quarters of the country got the Aadhaar card and rendered this litigation totally meaningless.
Exactly.
Now, similarly, in data collection and the need for a data protection law, the Indian government, I suppose, like many other governments, has a clear strategy. Carry on with the litigation, but carry on with the data collection. Accelerate.
In parallel, yes.
The data collection system, accelerate it. So as to make it meaningless, the ultimate result in court is of no consequence. You've got what you want. So you have data collection on a very huge scale, and you have data leakages to people who ought not to have that data on a massive scale. So secrecy has gone, privacy has gone. Puttaswamy, the great Puttaswamy judgment, is turning into an empty, worthless piece of paper. And that's the way capitalism operates today.
Thank you, Colin. There are a couple more questions lined up, so I'm afraid I'm not going to respond to everything you've said, although it's all in there. One question which actually Judith had asked earlier about judicial activism, she was questioning the role of courts in the context of strategic litigation, like all of the cases surrounding Aadhaar, and whether this level of involvement in protecting individual rights, even extending to creating rights, whether that kind of approach is justified, or is it veering too far towards judicial activism? Should there be some more deference to the legislative process? And I know you have very strong opinions on this matter.
See, deference to the legislature, deference to the executive is a lovely concept. But in the developing world, particularly, where the executive is brazen in its violation of human rights, and the legislature no less, the question really is, what should the court do? Should the court go by antiquated and obsolete notions of separation of power? Nice, do they sound? They sound very nice. The executive does its job, the legislature does its job, so judiciary should know its place and do its job. But when you are empowered, not just empowered, mandated under the Constitution to protect the human rights of all people, and you see the government betraying the people, and you see the legislature making draconian laws, what should you do? Should you sit back and say, oh no, I'm a judge, I can't do more than what I'm supposed to do, I can interpret the law, but I can't get into areas because of this magical, long-tested principle in law called separation of powers. And we as human rights activists, since we know our legislature is not going to improve, and we know that our executive is not going to improve and become worse over the years, we don't care a fig really for the separation of powers. And we go to the court and say, the government is defaulting again and again and again, like we do on food. Starvation deaths over 10 years. Are we going to say, as some Europeans may say, look, that's for the government. Go to the government, talk to the government. The judge may tell you, go to the government, speak to them. It's not our job to give you economic rights. But it's well established now. Years of struggle in the courts, well established. That you will not wait beyond the point. The judges will not wait beyond the point. And you are mandated under the Constitution to protect human rights. Therefore, if the government doesn't act, you will act. If Parliament makes a bad law, you will set it aside in a jiffy. Setting aside laws of Parliament or of the assemblies of the state, no big deal. Unconstitutional. Manifestly arbitrary as the ground for setting aside legislation. Manifestly arbitrary. So many statutes set aside on the ground that this statute is manifestly arbitrary. So it's a different world, and I think we must tune our jurisprudence and our teaching in colleges and law colleges particularly. We must tune it to a world that has changed completely. And not go by old standards. Forge new tools, judicial tools, legal tools, to tackle the menace of violation of human rights by those who are mandated, elected to protect human rights. And not sit tight as a judge and wash your hands. No, I'm sorry, I can't help you. This is not my area of work. That must stop.
I think even framing it as activism is a bit of a nonsense in your formulation. It's not activism if it is what you were elected to do in the first place. There's one final question that someone has asked, which might actually require a long response about when there's a clash between privacy and public security or corruption, how do we balance this? And I know this sort of balancing act is sort of a difficult question. If you feel you can engage with that in the few minutes left, that's great. Otherwise, I think the other question a couple of people have asked is whether there are any other key digital rights cases in India on the horizon that this community should be following. Are there any developments when it comes to new technologies, any movement on having a privacy law, anything on the horizon that we should keep a lookout for?
Well, the big thing on the horizon in India, if I can answer your second question first,
sure,
is Pegasus. And, yeah, and Pegasus is not really so big, although it's huge, that you know, snooped on everybody, politicians, judges, everybody. But it's the level of surveillance going on by the Indian government for years. And the level of surveillance is probably one of the highest in the world. And nobody in the world knows that this so-called democratic country is actually teaming up with some of the world's greatest despotic regimes, collecting all the technology and equipment that they want on a huge scale, and is intercepting communications and so on to the tune of something like 50,000 a month. 50,000. Huge interception, huge surveillance. That is the real now danger for all of us. And it's something that we don't seem to be able to handle. It's something that the courts are not able to handle. Everybody is unskilled in this level of barbarism, state barbarism and violation of rights. So we just don't know how to handle. That is the new challenge for human rights in the years to come. And the first question was, just repeat that to me, please. I get it.
It was about how you balance competing rights. Privacy is important, but so is fighting corruption, and so is security. How do you reconcile competing interests?
See, we are fed up in India. And I think the world is fed up with this national security, national sovereignty.
Exemptions.
Yeah, fed up.
Yes.
And we know that these are all bogus exemptions. And, you know, so I would always go in favor of privacy. I don't care for this national security exemption because I know the state is the greatest violator of human rights. And they are also the ones who thump their chest the most about security of the nation. It is they who undermine the security of the people. It's the state that undermines the security of the nation. And they're the first to wave the flag and say, look how nationalistic.
Look how clever we are. Yes. I've always.
Yeah, I'll go for privacy any day, any day.
I've always hated these sort of balancing metaphors. I've always said that the road to privacy hell is paved with balancing metaphors. And I don't think that's changing anytime soon. Colin, I'm just going to thank you because I think we're at time. I could have talked to you for hours, and I hope I do one day in your very nice office filled with tons of law books that I wish to read one day. Thank you for your time. It's been incredibly generous of you. I've really enjoyed hearing from you. It's been incredibly inspiring, even as someone who's been a lawyer for over 20 years. You filled me with joy about being part of this profession, and I hope a lot of that translated to the audience. I'm sure they did. Judith, let me hand over back to you in case you have any housekeeping and want to thank Colin on behalf of DFF as well.
Thank you very much, Malavika. I really very much want to do this. So thank you very much for moderating this event to you so splendidly. And thank you also to Colin for providing us with such a comprehensive insight. And really, you know, for all the fact that you may be no longer of the younger generation, a fiery spirit that you are actually, you know, calling upon, that you very clearly embody yourself. We feel very honored being able to learn from both of you today. And I hope that everybody really enjoyed this event as much as I have. Yes. So as far as housekeeping is concerned, going forward, so please note that this webinar has been recorded and that the recording will be made available on our website and on our YouTube channel soon, just as soon as we can get it up. For those of you who want to revisit anything that was discussed, and of course, for those of you who couldn't attend today, so if you know any of them, you know, point them our way. For the academics among you, also feel free to use the video in your teaching and maybe in your research. And I think that hopefully is, you know, another way of spreading the message to the younger generation. Our next event in the series will take place next week on Wednesday, the 13th of October, same time. And then we will be joined by Jedrek Niklas and Cengiz Baskanas to talk about profiling algorithms safeguarding the unemployed in Poland. There's still time to register for that event by following the link on our website. But for now, thank you very much, everybody, for participating today. And I hope you enjoyed the discussions. And on that note, it is now safe to leave. Thank you very much.